Welcome to Wildlife Outdoors with your host, Russell and Jose. If you have a passion for conservation of the outdoors, or you're enjoying a calming hike in the mountains, an exhilarating kayak trip on the river, feeling a fish on the end of your line, cooking on an open flame in a primitive campsite, or stalking big game, just waiting for the perfect shot, you're in the right place. So put on your boots and polarized sunglasses and come along for the ride.
Welcome back to the podcast, guys. This is a little different intro than we normally do. We have actually already had the interview with Mr. Scott Eggemeyer, but it started off hot. And so we did not want to interrupt that and do an intro. So we're doing it after the fact. But this episode is me, Russell, with Jose and Wildlife Outdoors. And we are interviewing a man who is just a wealth of knowledge, wealth of experience. He is actually a former fly fishing guide in Alaska for 20 years and is an avid outdoorsman when it comes to hunting and fishing, and now lives in South Texas. So if you guys are interested in anything like that, his stories are just amazing. And for those of you that are watching, we're actually wearing new Wildlife Outdoors gear. So tune in for that. We have some merch for sale, and here goes the interview.
No, that's why I like river fishing more than anything.
Right.
Which brings us back to Florida Caña. So we're in Nicaragua, and I think it was 2004, maybe three. And a friend of mine had said, "Hey, man, you got to come down to Nicaragua and fish these tarpon." I said, "Well, are we fly fishing them? Are we plugging for them? What are we doing? They're in a river, so they're setting up for spawn." He goes, "Yeah, we're like a month ahead of spawn." I'm like, "Right on. Okay, we're not interrupting. The spawn must go on. Let's not jack that up." And he's like, no, you'll love it. So these guys have never even seen a spey rod before in their life.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. We're breaking out 12-foot spey rods. Basically, it's a 12-weight, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've all got Abels and Tibors on and ungodly amounts of backing. We get out there, and we're just cooning these fish. Oh, my God. It was brutal. We tied these flies that were like half plug, half fly, and just dripping them through the water and letting them tail out like you do with a spey rod normally. And the hits were just jarring. It was like you hit a softball wrong. You're just crushing it. And so I said to my guide, I'm like, "Hey, man, so I'm in Nicaragua. I need rum and I need cigars." He goes, "Scott, man, it's not a problem, brother. From the hacienda, we go 7 miles this way, we're at Florida Caña. We go 7 miles that way, we're at Rocky Patel." I'm like, "Well, I know Rocky, I don't know Florida, so let's go find out." And I don't think I've ever drank another rum since.
Really?
Wow. Oh, yeah. Florida Caña, their 18-year-old is, that's God's gift to humanity right there.
Now, I don't think I've ever had Florida Caña.
I don't think I have either.
Brothers, do yourselves a favor. An 18-year-old bottle of Florida Caña at Total Wines is $47.
Really?
That's not bad. And occasionally you might need an ice cube. Maybe.
Yeah.
Don't splurge on the 25. I've done it many times. It's good, but it's not that much better.
I see.
And you definitely don't need Coke.
Yeah, I'm not much of a mixing Coke in my rum or if I'm drinking a mixed drink, it's going to be a cheap liquor.
Right. And so, they've got the Florida Caña 7-year, which is $30 for a liter and a half, 1.75.
So I see.
Mix that one.
Yeah. Right. Sounds like a better mix in rum.
Yeah.
For sure. See, I've dabbled mostly like in bourbons and stuff, and I was introduced to two rums that I really liked. One was Zacapa.
Oh yeah.
I think it was Zacapa's really good. I like that one a lot. And then the other one was it was Diplomatico Especial.
I was about to say that.
Yep,
Diplomatico. Yeah, that was. Yeah, that's probably my favorite so far. But if you really like Florida Caña, I'm going to have to take your word up on it and try to give it a shot.
Give it a shot, brother. I think you'll be happy. It kind of tastes like a bourbony molasses.
Well, that sounds right up my alley. Yeah, right? You have to give that a shot.
So you've got that going for you. And then Zacapa, if you like bourbon, right? So if you mix that Zacapa into an old fashioned, that is another world.
That sounds interesting. I've never even about replacing rum or bourbon with a rum in an old fashioned.
Absolutely.
I'm going to give that a go. That sounds really good, actually.
Not in a Manhattan, but definitely in fact, guys, I'm sure Buffy has your email. We'll send you guys the inebriology report. Right. So the inebriology report was made up by four very bored chemical engineers. And we went and we researched all the different old fashioned or not old fashioned, but other world, latter day, if you will, recipes. And then we rewrote them according to specific gravity so that every cocktail will layer.
I see. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Well, we were bored. So
yeah,
British.
I've made some concoctions out of boredom myself. I think it was last year, the year before, I was just like, I have a bunch of liquor from when I got married and I had an open bar, but I had to provide all the alcohol.
Amazing.
And so
how that works. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I still have all this liquor and I was like, I need to get rid of some of this. And I'm one of those guys where I just like creating stuff. It doesn't matter what kind of it, like whether it's some type of art or whatever, just like creating. And so I went through and took all of the Girl Scout cookies and made a cocktail for all the Girl Scout cookies.
Nice.
And so that was pretty interesting. And that came out of boredom. And a lot of them were surprisingly really good.
Oh my God. One year in Alaska, it was February, right? And I was helping out the local bar owner. I was bartending at night and everything else to do. I mean, what else are you going to do when it's 23 hours of darkness?
Right, right.
We came up with a bear butts on acid.
So what is that? That sounds interesting.
Yeah, oh yeah. It tastes just like Bubblicious. So, see, you got it. So the bear butts on acid was just, it starts out just like a Long Island iced tea. It's all the whites, and then a shot of cranberry, a splash of peach schnapps, and 7-Up. And then you shake.
Oh, that sounds good.
Shake it over ice and then pour it like a shot. And I swear to God, it tastes, you can't taste any alcohol. It tastes just like Bubblicious, and four or five of those. And yeah, you don't really care what time it is.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Dangerous. Yeah.
Is it June yet? Can we drop it? Let's go.
See, that sounds similar to a drink that I make. So, do you know an AMF? Adios, mother effer? Okay, yep. So I make a tropical one of those, and instead of putting tequila, I double up on the rum. So I'll do a coconut rum, and then I'll do a spiced rum. And then instead of using a Sprite, I use pineapple juice. Right on. And it's more of a tropical tiki-style drink, but it's the same thing, all your whites. So it's very heavy on the alcohol. It's pretty good.
So it's kind of like a planner's punch.
I'm not familiar with that one. It might be.
Yeah, the only thing that's different of a planter's punch is there's going to be some kind of guava, mango, papaya.
I see.
Some kind of nonsense in there. Because, you know, when you're in the islands, you know, if you're in anywhere in the Caribbean, the alcohol is the cheap part of the drink.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The alcohol didn't cost you nothing. I mean, a decent bottle of Lemon Heart 151. Which is so much better than that Cuban wannabe. We won't even say the name. but the Lemon Heart 151, you can get a gallon of that stuff for $7 to $8.
Wow. Really?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay, so where are we going next, Jose?
Wherever that place is at, I don't know.
What y'all need to do is spin the globe and throw a dart at it. Wherever that dart is within 100 miles, I will probably know a guide, if not a full-blown outfitter.
Wow.
Good to know.
So, literally, a friend of mine, and I'm not a name dropper like Buffy is, but a friend of mine called me one year, and he said, Scott, I want to go to Mauritius, but I want to fish it like we're in on the African side. I said, yeah, okay. He's like, you said that like it's easy. I said, it is. When did you want to go? I said, it's the Indian Ocean, brother. Give me a break. I'm like, Sri Lanka's just north of you. So we got this. Are you ready? Bring 10 weights and 12 weights and at least six lines for each rod. He's like, so I'm changing lines every night? And I said, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
That's freaking crazy. Just because the size of the fish and the amount of pressure on them or what? Yeah. Why would you have to change a line so frequently?
Yeah, because you don't know if you're going to catch a GT or if you're going to catch a Pacific style blue big eye tuna.
You I see.
Because they're both.
I had some big eye tuna the other day and it was amazing. Some seared big eye tuna.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
So never caught one.
That's my other career. I was actually a cook at one point.
I see.
In my life. So we ate some. We still do.
That's awesome.
So me and Jose are both pretty passionate in food. Food, photography, and obviously fishing. So that's one thing is I just love making stuff from things that I harvest myself or things that I've grown. So me and Jose had an idea that at some point throughout this podcast, we would like to make a cookbook based on regions. So say you're going to be in this part of the country, you can find natural herbs and vegetables and fruit from this part of the country that also pair with the harvest, whether it be a fish or big game or whatever the case. So that's kind of one of our long-term goals is come up with a cookbook related to that. So it's pretty interesting that you actually used to be a chef.
I'd love to help. I'd love to help out with that. You know, I've tried to write cookbooks on multiple occasions. And unfortunately, the stories that go with the recipes override the cooking, and nobody really cares about the cooking.
Right,
right. They really care about the story, which is fine.
Yeah.
I love it. Like, for instance, grayling, right? Mm-hmm. A grayling's Latin name is Articus thalamus. Mm-hmm. So the herb thyme, that's thalamus in Latin. So
I see.
If you cook a grayling with just butter, salt, and pepper over the grill or over the fire, it literally has a natural thyme flavor.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
So that's so interesting. Like, I've heard of people wanting like to go fishing for grayling, catch a grayling, but I've never heard anybody like describe what a grayling tastes like, or even as like table fare. That's pretty impressive. I would love to give that a shot.
Well, so there's two creatures in Alaska that nobody talks about eating because we don't want everybody to know about it. Because if you get stuck out in the middle of nowhere for multiple days, you got to go to God's deep freeze to survive.
And
those are grouse, spruce grouse,
yep,
and grayling. Well, they're both stupid. I mean, they're both just dumber than shit. The first grouse that I killed with a flay knife. I literally speared with a flay knife.
No way.
Oh, yeah,
really? About
6 feet. And I speared.
That's freaking crazy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So knowing that grayling are pretty stupid kind of makes sense why a grayling would hit my strike indicator instead of my fly.
Oh, all day long.
Made me absolutely heartbroken because it was a closed down stretch of the body of water that comes off of Angel Rocks up there just outside of Chena.
Yeah.
And everything was closed down because of the wildfires. And so sure. I was like, I have to fish this. There's a fallen log. There's a ripple. Like, I have to. So we pulled off in the closed area. And I had 15 minutes. I was like, I'm going to give myself 15 minutes and I'm going to fish. And so first cast, and I don't remember what I had on. Doesn't I think matter. I had some type of nymph or midge, and it was on a strike indicator. Sure. Right at perfect cast, grayling hit my strike indicator. I was like, so I obviously didn't land it. And then I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to swap out my strike indicator and run a hopper dropper, and didn't get another bite. Oh. I was just like, just getting tore up by mosquitoes. Didn't catch the freaking grayling. I need to now.
What a wonderful place. That's actually owned by a gentleman named Bernie Carl, who is the original outlaw. And I don't think that guy's got an honest bone in his body, which is fine. Except in Fairbanks, so who cares?
Right, right.
You know, and they're on the eastern side, so he might as well be Canadian.
Right.
But, the Chena River was wonderful for grayling, but if you get down to the Kenai Peninsula, and even out west over on the Good News River, you know, your grayling are going to go from 12 to 15 inches to 17 to 25.
Really? Wow. I didn't know they got that big.
Yeah, my biggest grayling on tape was 25 3/4.
I want to say. Wow.
Yeah.
That's freaking awesome.
I was just shy of the state record. I didn't even know it. Of course, we let
That's
it go.
That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. We let it go. I could care less.
Yeah.
I've never been a records guy.
And right.
That rainbow that I landed on the Kenai in 07, you know, Fish and Game was all over me to apply for a record. And I'm like, nah.
And how big was that one?
It was 38.5 inches.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
See, I'm not huge on wanting to have a record. My thing, though, is I experienced it.
I had
those memories. I've been through the experience. Granted, would I like to have a picture or footage of it? Absolutely.
Sure.
But do I care to be in a record book?
Nope.
That's secondary. You know? If it happens, it happens. But I'm not going to jump through hoops to make it happen.
No. I totally agree, guys. I couldn't agree more. You know, I remember this Christmas party at my house 1 year. I don't know. There were 35, 40 people there. And a bunch of guides and their significant others. Of course, we all marry way over our heads, but that's what we do. I mean, y'all met Buffy. So, this guy said to a really good friend of mine, he said, everybody knows that trout's not real. That was up in the center post of my cabin.
Uh-huh.
And my good friend, Josh Hayes, tells this character, he's like, two things. One, nobody gives a shit about your opinion. And two, I promise you, Scott didn't have that 38.5-inch trout mounted for you.
Nice. Love it.
Both valid points.
Yeah. You
know, he doesn't give a shit. And, you know, that was the big thing. You know, up there, you know, we were fly fishing guides first.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to salmon fish for economics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So from July 1st to July 31st, we did the whole king salmon thing, which is pretty much like watching paint dry. Or as a really good client of mine described it one time, he goes, this is periods of boredom broken up by moments of pandemonium.
I like that description.
I do. I'd like to experience it, but... Just well, a few times.
When you want to experience that, let me know. We're going to send you up to fish with Josh. He does a hell of a job. He was always way better than I was. That's kind of a funny story if y'all want to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there might have been some libations had that evening. and there could have been some of God's herb shared that night. So the discussion was, who are the top five guides on the Kenai? So the Kenai River is 89 miles long.
Mm-hmm.
Starts at a glacier, ends at saltwater.
Mm-hmm.
It's divided up into four sections. The top section, anybody can guide. The next section is 14 permits only. Okay, so 14 individuals can guide that section of the river.
I see.
Then you get what's called the middle river, and that's from mile 50 down to mile 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the bottom 20 miles. So anybody can guide. You just have to get all your paperwork done, which is tumultuous, except for that third section. So anyway, normally when that conversation happens, you're looking for people that don't have that permit.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the only one that made the cut that didn't have that permit. And the way it went was, of course, Josh was number one.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of the other guides that had full permits, blah, blah, blah. And then one of the other people, not me, I was staying really quiet in the corner, sipping really good tequila. And one of them said, well, Scott does great. I mean, he guides 150 days a year, 2 to 3 trips a day. Why isn't he in this? And I said, well, because I'll get my ass handed to me in the refuge. They're like, yeah, but the rest of the river, nobody's going to get near you. So I got lumped into that crowd.
Hey, there ain't nothing wrong with that.
That speaks volumes. No, it was kind of like the Golden Globes. It was a bunch of your peers nominating you for something. So it was kind of cool.
That is awesome.
Gentlemen, we live an absolute charmed life.
It sounds like it. Yeah. It looks like it.
What are y'all's deal? I mean, what do y'all want to do? What have you done?
So I haven't done much. I mean, I've traveled a lot and I've fished in a lot of places. My goal is to eventually be living the lifestyle of essentially traveling the world, documenting everything that I do, but at the same time, educating the public on how conservation works, the best tactics, and everything for everything out there, whether it be fishing, hunting, hiking, camping, anything to do with the outdoors and connecting the newer generation of people to the outdoors. Because I had this realization that fly fishing is making a resurgence. There's a lot of younger people. Speaking of which, I went and went fly fishing, urban fly fishing on a creek a couple of days ago. And there was a younger, I would assume he was probably 15 or so, out there fly fishing on the creek, which was like awesome for me. I was like, that is cool. So I noticed that there's a resurgence of that. And I kind of want to encourage that because we all know this world's going to hell in a handbasket. If I could, you know, have any type of way to get people in the outdoors and away from the TV screens and the media and all this crap, I want to do it. But the younger generation all communicates through these platforms. So if there's a way that I can get in these platforms and put the proper information out there and education and experiences out there and get people in the outdoors more, that's what I want to do. But along the way, I want to have all these trips. I want to experience all these things. I want to go to all these different countries and different parts of the world and catch different fish and, you know, hunt different large game and stuff like that. So that's kind of the goal that I have. And I want my kids to grow up in a world knowing that there's more than just what is in the inner city or more than what is, you know, just in the far corners of the U.S. Like, I want them to experience all these different cultures and ways to do things for, God forbid something happened, we all have to survive, you know, with nothing. I want them to be able to.
That's awesome. That really is. I mean, so you're looking at being a combination Stu Ept, Lefty Cray, Fred Bear, and Carter Andrews.
That would be the dream. If I could ever get to that point, that would be amazing.
I'm lucky enough to have known all those people except Mr. Bear, obviously, because, well, I was 4 when he passed away. But yeah, the other ones I do know or did know.
That's awesome.
Forgive me for not mentioning Jose Wahebe, who was our ambassador for so long, but Carter was right there to stand in his stead, and Carter and Wahebe were phenomenal friends. Mm-hmm. And they really were. They were just great friends. And right now our biggest ambassador probably to date is Carter. You know, and I've known him since he was a punk kid from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, because I was a punk kid from Alaska.
So are you originally from Alaska, or what took you to Alaska?
Well, so, you know, funny story, depending upon how sadistic you are. I graduated college. I went to culinary school. From there, I went to Europe and cooked. I came home, opened up a bunch of microbreweries for a company in Ohio.
That's also one of our goals, is to open a brewery or distillery.
Yeah, pretty much. If you start with a million, you might make two.
Really?
No. You know, there's a reason why the majority of those things suck, is because the people that have the money to do it don't know how. Mm. And we make a peach brandy here at the house every year that people are dying for the recipe. Like, do you want to make money with it? And they're like, well, yeah. I said, then don't do it.
Yeah.
By the time you finish, there's no money.
Right.
You know, unless you want to get into the Louis Trey world, which, you know, nobody has that kind of scratch. So, but, you know, those are wonderful goals to have. I mean, the next generation is going to need a new ambassador.
Yeah.
And nobody knows who that is.
Exactly.
Right? And you can get the latest up and coming, you know, Key West guide, but until they have the fortitude to realize what they've got, I mean, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, we lost Travis Holman 2 years ago to complications from COVID.
Yeah.
And, you know, Travis was phenomenal. I remember Travis when he was 25 years old in the bow of my boat. He caught his first 30-inch rainbow, and he thought he was God until he hooked a 36. And then he realized he wasn't.
That's freaking crazy, though. I can't even imagine a 30-inch plus rainbow. Like, I mean, obviously, I've seen the pictures and seen the videos, but I can't even fathom having that happen.
You know, you need to realize and throw another caveat in there that the majority of those fish hit within 6 to 10 feet of the boat.
Wow.
Really?
That's insane.
Yeah. You're not making these 90-foot bucket casts. You know, my clients, I told them, I'm like, look, if that strike indicator is more than twice the length of your fly rod, you're out of the fish.
Yeah.
Because my boat's where the fish are.
Yep.
And they're eating salmon eggs, for God's sake. So it's not like they're going anywhere.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You know, and, you know, bypass all the nonsense where they're like, oh, we got to be on the bow because the bow is the best place to be. I'm like, yeah, that's if the bow gets there first. But up here, the motor gets there first. So you probably want to cheat back about 15 feet.
Right, right.
You know, and there was that whole thing. I mean, my best clients that I ever had, and from a guide standpoint, the best clients are people that book the same week every year, tip extraordinarily, and are fun to be around.
Yep.
In that order. And paying cash. And, you know, the male of the couple got it immediately. He's like, Scott, this is where I need to be. I said, that's where your chair is. Yeah. And his wife would make a mad dash up my 20-foot skiff to get on the bow. I said, okay,
but
probably not.
Right.
And he would, every year for 17 years, he caught at least one 30-inch rainbow during the 7 days that he was fishing. Wow.
That's freaking insane.
At least one.
That's awesome.
It's insane.
So I kind of interrupted you on your story on how you ended up in Alaska. So I apologize about that.
No. I had a life change, and a friend of mine that I knew, he and I were drunk on the internet one night. I recommend that to everyone. Get hammered and get on the internet.
I have a lot of gadgets because of doing that exact same thing.
Yeah, you'll wind up doing shit you never thought of. We both wound up with jobs at the Kenai Princess Lodge in Cooper Landing, Alaska, which is the headwater for the Kenai River.
Uh-huh.
So I woke up the next day and went, well, shit, we better go. So we loaded up my Bronco and started driving. And this is back when Broncos were Broncos.
Right, right.
And we drove up there and got to the lodge, got our jobs, got our housing, the whole nine yards. And I am looking at the most beautiful turquoise river I've ever seen. But I also knew that I didn't know shit about it. So I took my last $500 and I booked us a guided trip.
Uh-huh.
And this was at the beginning of season when the fishing's not that great. And we landed, so I don't remember the exact number, but somewhere between 30 and 50 rainbows.
Oh, wow.
And I said, yeah, I'm done. I'm here. This is where I live.
Yeah.
The hell with it.
That's freaking awesome.
That's badass.
Yeah. And I literally said, you know, come hell or high water, I'm going to fish this river for the rest of my life. And I did. I just didn't know I was going to turn into a guide.
Right, right.
And I followed a guy up his driveway that had a certain college logo on the back of his truck that might have looked like an ATM sign. I don't know. And I got up there and I said, "Hey, are you up?" And he said, "I am." I said, "Me too. What do you do for a living?" He said, "Well, I have a guide service." I said, "No shit." I said, "Well, I just got here and I've been fishing and I've been having a ball." He's like, "Well, I'm fixing to leave for Iliamna next week." I said, "Shit, that's my birthday." He's like, "Well, come on, Ag." Oh, shit. I said it. "Come on, Ag. Let's go fishing." Now, I don't know where Iliamna is. I don't know what "Hey, let's go fishing." Little did I know, I show up where I was told to go, and I'm getting into a de Havilland Beaver, and I'm flying 4 hours west of where I live.
That sounds like an experience on its own.
Oh, my God. We got stuck out there for 19 days.
That's awesome.
Holy shit.
Yeah, we were supposed to be there for 7, and we got stuck for 19 days.
So how did that happen?
Ice. Ice.
There's a lot of that out there.
Yeah, well, when the wings ice up, you ain't going anywhere. Yeah,
right, right.
So we stuck around. We fished. I cooked, obviously, because that's what I could do. And when we got back, the old boy said, "Hey, I'm going to offer you a job to be a guide for me next year." And I said, "Ken, I don't know shit about being a guide." He said, "You've been doing it for the last 3 weeks." He said, "Your job is to keep the tourists calm and help them catch fish."
Right.
"I'll teach you the little nuances that you need to know, but you have everything that you need."
That's awesome.
And my career was born. So from 1997 until 2017, I guided between 150 and 160 days a year.
Wow. That's freaking cool. And it's crazy how organic that is. Like,
yeah,
you know, you hear the guide stories of, "Oh, well, I knew I liked fishing and I wanted to make money, so I just applied." And you hear the, "Oh, I went to the Orvis fly fishing school and, you know, there I met somebody and did it." But yours is completely organic. Seeing a sticker and following him into his driveway. That's amazing.
You know, and you know, it's funny that you bring that up. I had a great, what do they call that? A great nephew, or no, a great cousin, second cousin. And he was telling me how he was going to go to Colorado at a Telluride, and he was going to work at this fly shop, and he was going to become a fly fishing guide. Mm-hmm. I said, "You're not. Just go back to school right now and just get it out of your head. Go get a job. Go get an education so you can get a job and hire fishing guides."
Yeah.
Well, he met KT Townsend, you know, Kevin Townsend down in Port O'Connor, and they went out one day and he saw Kevin's house and he's like, "Man, this is what I want. You know, there's fly rods all over the place and all big, crazy, stupid fish that Kevin has been lucky enough to catch." And he called me up. He says, "Scott, you're not going to believe where I was." I said, "Of course I am. I'm the one that booked your trip." He said, "This is what I want." I said, "It's not." I said, "You've never been in this situation where you're down to your last $5,000 and it's the end of the season because you had to replace 2 motors and a set of oar locks and a set of oars and all your profit went away. And now you got to try to figure out what you can do to get to June."
Right.
I said, "You've never been there. You've been in Katy, Texas, living in your mom and dad's house. It's $500,000. And you're just upset because you don't have enough money to go out on Friday night."
Yeah.
I said, "Dude, stop yeah, whatever it is that your brain is telling you." I said, "Being a fishing guide is liking Shiner Bock and drinking Olympia because it's what you can afford."
Right. Right.
You know, and until you know how to make ramen taste good, you're not ready to be a fishing guide.
See, I'm glad that you brought that up because, to be totally transparent, at one point in my life, I was convinced that I wanted to try and go the guide route also. And then I wound up watching a video. I think it was by April Wilkie. It was somebody, but it was like titled like, so
April.
So
April's a trip.
I would love the chance to meet her. I've only seen some of her content on YouTube, but she's awesome. And I think she made, I'm sorry if it wasn't her, I'm fairly sure it wasn't. I mean, I'm fairly sure it was, but I think the video was titled "So You Want to Be a Guide" or something like that. And it talked about all these things that you know you needed to really consider if you want to be a guide. And as I'm working through it, I'm like, Jesus, man, like I never thought about that stuff. And I mean, like, to be fair, like, I think that in the moment, like, doing what they're doing, it's probably one of the best jobs you can have. But all the stresses that come with it, I mean, it's a lot. And I think it's something a lot of people, especially a lot of the younger kids who don't have a lot of, like, life experience, really, truly grasp. And, like, for me, it was like an eye-opener. Like, I was like, man, I wanted to do this, but I don't know if I'm cut out to do that. And it is kind of like a special breed that you kind of got to be, you know, to be a guide, especially a great guide. You know, it's man, the utmost respect to y'all. It's pretty incredible. I mean, I like the idea of it, but when it comes down to whether or not I can do it, it's like a whole nother ball game. I don't think I can, but yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Well, don't sell yourself short. You know, don't ever do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, go into it with your eyes open that, you know, so what I would tell I started off in Alaska working as a fly-in fishing guy.
Okay.
Right? Which is the least stressful you could ever possibly have. Right? So the most stress I had was this Brit who showed up with the most beautiful bamboo spay rod. It was gorgeous. Oh my God. I mean, I'm sitting there with a Sage 8-weight RPLXI. That's how old I am. And, you know, I'm thinking this is the bee's knees, right? This is the shit. And this guy shows up with a large Arbor handmade reel from Purdy and this spay rod bamboo that didn't even have a name on it, but it had red and gold wraps because nobody knows what that means. And he's laying line like a prince. So I tie on my best, most beautiful 6-inch king fly, which he throws out there like a pro, lays it in there, does it downstream in, gets the eat, feels the first two jumps, feels the first run, and hands the rod to me. He's like, here you go, young man. Just fight that one on in for me so I can get another one.
Wow.
Really? I'm like, what?
I said, okay. So I pick up this rod that's worth more than my whole life, bring it in, release the fish, turn it loose, and hand him back his stuff, and okay, go do it again. He does it, and we do that all day long. Well, I get back to the lodge at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, do my dinner chores, glad hand all the clients, put them to bed, and then I stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning tying lawyer flies, egg sucking leeches, and tied a loop knot, put them on his fly. And that day I tied 6-pound monofilament onto his tippet. She felt the first two jumps, the first run, bink. He goes, oh, that one got off. I went, it did. And he reeled in, and I tied another one on for him, and he caught fish all day long. I went back to the lodge, did the same thing, came out with a dozen egg-sucking leeches, and off he goes. At the end of the week, he tips me extraordinarily, and he says, you figured it out. And I said, yes, sir. You're in it for the buzz, not for the feel.
Yeah.
He goes, well done. You'll go far.
That's awesome.
And once I figured that out, that people, you know, it's like tarpon fishing, right? You know, whether you're casting to a porpoising fish, or you're drifting little duck key at night, you're still getting the same adrenaline rush because you feel that initial tug, and the three jumps and the run and break that bastard off, let him get back to living, tie on another goddamn tarpon slug and throw it out there. Because who gives a damn? You know, you don't have to bring that fish to the boat to feel good about yourself.
Exactly.
You know, the best picture I saw on Facebook today was this guy. He was down, it looked by the water color alone, it looked like he was down somewhere south of Baffin, probably south of Lancut, probably in the upper part of Port Mansfield. And he had a 27-inch snook.
He caught the snook,
released it, called it a day, and said, boys, this was epic. I'm done. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
There were two pictures and done. I'm like, yeah, he gets it.
Yes.
You counted coup on that 27-inch snook.
Yep.
You need to eat it? Probably not. Because if you can afford to take the trip that it took to get you there, you're probably okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's what has been so interesting to me in moving to the lower 48. So, you know, I met Buffy, got her into fly fishing. She just sucked it up like a crab. It's unbelievable. But she would have these clients, you know, of hers who would say, well, how many fish are you bringing home? We don't bring fish home. We release them.
Right.
But we don't understand. You spend all this money and all this time. You don't bring anything home?
It's for the experience.
Yeah, it's for the experience.
Yeah.
They just couldn't get it.
There's some people that don't. And that's one thing that's strange to me is because I live my life for experiences. I don't live my life for materialistic things. I don't live my life for what other people think about me. I live my life for my life experience and things that I enjoy doing and the memories that I can make and things that I can pass down, memories, stories, to my kids, you know, that's what I live my life for. That's what I get off on, is making these memories and going to these places, you know, and if there's good food involved, great. If it's something that I harvested, even better, but I don't have to do that. It's the experience in general that I love.
Jose, what do you think?
I kind of fall somewhere in between. So personally, so growing up, my family and I, we fished a lot. But we kept most of the fish that we caught, so long as they were legal, of course. It wasn't until it started with bass, because of course, like, at least for me, like, I grew up watching like Bassmaster Classic, all that stuff. And you know, they were always releasing fish.
Watching the boys.
Yeah. And so at some point I got to this point in my life where I was just catching and releasing fish, mostly bass, mostly freshwater fish, actually. I went to school down in Kingsville for a few years. So I met some
javelinas.
Yeah, exactly. And so I met some really good friends, and we were hunting, we were fishing pretty much every weekend. And we kept a lot of the fish that we caught, because we would go home and we would, like, after it was done, and we would, like, you know, we'd cook them out. We would cook out and we would, you know, drink some beer, whatever, have a lot of fun. And that was part of the experience for us. Making those memories. And then
my childhood.
And then my family, they don't get to go down to the coast as often. So I would save up a bunch of meat and take it to them, because for them it was more of like a delicacy, if you will, something that they don't often get to have, like fresh saltwater fish. And they loved it. They loved it when I would do that. They were kind of disappointed when I didn't, when I started transitioning into more like catch and release fishing. And so here, and it started, I guess, more when I picked up the fly rod, that I started focusing more on like catch and release fishing. That being said, I'm not opposed to keeping fish. I think it's, you know, it's something that's well within a person's right to do so. And if that's what's part of the experience for them, I don't think it's my place to judge. I think I do have an issue when, like, a person has to go out and has to catch their limit every time and take that limit home every time just to kind of have that satisfaction. I think there's a deeper question to be asked, like, why do you feel the need to do that? And because it's not necessary. If you want to catch a, you know, catch some fish and keep a few here and there, I have no issues with that. whatsoever. But so I would say that I fall somewhere in between, because for me, like, even though I catch and release fish predominantly now, I'm not opposed to keeping some. And actually I have been wanting to go back down to the coast and keep like one redfish and maybe a few trout to bring back to the family and, you know, make some like redfish on the half shell or some beach or something like that for them to try and share those experiences with them, because that's not something that they can just do or even have the want to go and do. Whereas for me, it's kind of both. Like, I have the satisfaction of going and fishing and experiencing that for myself, but then also I get to share that with them through like the food and we can, and all that stuff, especially with like my grandpa who got me into fishing. He's of the age now, and he also has some health issues where he doesn't often, well, actually he hasn't gone fishing in many, many years. And so, you know, whenever I go fishing, like, he always asks about my story, like, and I get to tell that. And it's almost like, I mean, just through his facial expressions, like, he's living kind of vicariously through me, you know, like it's almost like he's there, you know, and he loves to hear about the stories, and I love to tell them, you know, and so that's part of the experience for me. So for me, I love being in the outdoors, and it means a lot to me. It means a lot. I can't imagine a life where I'm not doing that, you know, and it scares me to think about the future where inevitably I'm going to come to a point in my life where maybe I'm not physically able to do that and other stuff. And of all the things, not being able to spend time outdoors like I am able to now, that's what, you know, it scares me. And if I'm being quite honest, so being able to be outdoors, whether I'm catching fish or not, just being able to be out there. And if I'm able to share that with other people, you asked Russell, you asked us, you know, what we're into and all that stuff. And for me, you know, and this kind of, I guess, your question of what I think about it kind of bleeds into that is, you know, I want to be in the outdoors. I want to share those experiences with people, whether it's through pictures or stories or through food, through this podcast or whatever the case may be, by taking people who may not have had the chance to go out and do it themselves, or maybe not even consider it, you know, before. Like, you know, I was fortunate enough to get Russell into fly fishing, and I was able to introduce a few other people into fly fishing and fishing in general. And to see them like take off with it and get really into it. And it has been an incredible pleasure, and it's been an incredible experience. And so, I guess it's a long-winded and way roundabout way of answering your question as to how I feel about it. I don't really care if people keep fish or not, as long as they're doing so responsibly. I do have some concerns, as you know, if their main point is going out and getting their limit every single time and taking that home, I think there are perhaps some deeper questions that need to be asked as to like why one would want to do that. But, you know, that's as long as they're following the rules and regulations set forth by their respective, you know, wildlife and fisheries agencies who have done the research, have put in the work to make sure the regulations are set in place to fulfill everyone's wants and needs, like for yours and for them, then I don't have an issue. Like, I don't think it's my place to judge. And so, so I guess that's, you know, my stance there.
That's awesome. That was a great explanation of where I think people, at least along the Gulf Coast, sans Louisiana, are. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I want to cut Louisiana out of the deal because their trout just don't get big enough.
Yeah,
they don't. We fished early last spring with one of the preeminent trout guides on the lower Louisiana coast. Mm-hmm. We didn't touch a fish that was over 22 inches.
Wow. Really?
Redfish, of course.
Yeah.
But we didn't touch a trout over 22 inches.
That's crazy.
And Tony Kapkowski asked me, like, Scott, how does this compare? I said, it doesn't. I said, I don't remember a time today when I didn't have a fish on. But that fish was 12 to 20 inches.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Okay. A great question. Why do you think every tournament, every weekend in the bass world ends with a 10 pound fish in a stringer of five winning?
Somebody that knows it, maybe.
Very good answer. Very politically correct. What I would say is that the ability to catch a 10-pound fish exists because of the catch and release culture.
This is true.
I delete somebody every week off of my Facebook because all I see from them is trout on a nail board.
So they're not allowing them to get big enough. And yeah.
Do I keep a limit of fish every now and then? Yep, sure do. You know why? Because I'm out of a job right now, and this is God's deep freeze in South Texas, and he allocates me to, because of my whatever, I'm not going to call it talent because I don't think it is, to go out and catch three fish under 24 inches.
Yeah, but it's not an everyday occurrence for you.
You know, my normal day fishing in the Laguna Madre, whether it's Galveston or Port Mansfield, is 60 to 80 fish. That's just reality.
Yeah.
Now, does that mean that I know where to go? Probably. Does it mean that I've been fishing here since I was five? Probably. Does it mean I use live bait? No. Mm-hmm. I refuse.
Yeah.
Because that's, to me, that's not fishing, that's harvesting.
Right.
And if that's what you want to do, you know, go with God. Do that.
Yeah.
But understand, the reason that more 30-inch trout aren't caught is because we're killing them at 24.
Yeah.
Do y'all know that there has not been a golden croaker harvested south of Port Mansfield in the last 2 years?
Really?
I did not know that. I've never even heard of a golden croaker, I don't think.
Yeah, well, that's what the croaker are. The croaker that people are putting on their hooks and throw them out there with a big egg sinker, mm-hmm, and dragging them off the rocks. Golden croaker.
I see.
Before y'all were born, and I don't mean to sound like that, but that's just the way it works, right? So back in the 70s, golden croaker were sought after as sport fish. We ate them because they were between 2 and 3 pounds.
Really?
Yes. And now the only time you see a golden croaker over eight ounces is when there's a fish kill and they wash up on 3 Mile.
I see. Yeah, every croaker that I've caught has been quite small.
Yeah, for sure. And that's because we're netting the shit out of them and we're selling them for a buck a piece.
I see. So there's no effort into the restoration for croaker.
No. And the people like Scott Murray was one of the most, the preeminent marine biologist for Baffin Bay. He now has a diminutive disease that is literally killing him. And we are less for it.
I see.
Scott Murray said, under no uncertain circumstances, the more that we use croaker in this fishery, the closer we are to killing it. Hmm. To get a guide's license in the state of Texas takes $1,500 and a pen.
Really?
That's it. You go pass your Coast Guard test. Ooh, there's a challenge. You write the state of Texas, $1,500 check, and you get your guide's license. And then next week, you've got four guys in your boat that paid $300 from Austin to soak croaker.
Huh.
They catch their three trout and possibly two redfish and maybe a flounder because somebody screwed up and let it sink to the bottom. And they go home happy and they rebook.
I see. I didn't realize that it was so easy to get a guide's license.
It's nothing. Hmm. Nothing.
Interesting.
I mean, it's almost easier than Alaska, which I didn't think was possible.
But there's far less people up in Alaska doing the same thing. So
there are, except that we use all artificial because bait is a no-go.
Yeah.
You know, you actually have to have some strategy. You actually have to have some technique.
Exactly.
Normally what happens in Alaska is you go to work for an outfitter the first year, you break out on your own the second year, and the third year you fail.
So there's a quick turnaround.
3 years.
Yep. That's crazy.
And, you know, the old timers, which I was one once, I met a kid that had been guiding for 7 years. He's like, Scott, I just hope I can make it. I said, you can. You're already past the bubble.
Yeah.
You did it. Now go invest in some fly rods and get into the game.
Right. Where
people are going to pay you to show up.
That's crazy.
It's a destination fishery.
Yeah.
Texas is not a destination fishery. You will never hear somebody on a podcast say, oh, my God, I can't wait to go to Texas and fish Baffin Bay to the rocks because, you know, when you fish tide gauge, you're going to catch a 30-inch trout.
Yeah.
You're not going to hear that because the people that are fishing tide gauge are soaking croaker.
That's crazy. Yeah, I haven't used live bait or cut bait in years.
Why would you? You have the technical skills to not need it.
Right, right. And that's one thing that I don't remember what podcast it was. We were talking on a previous podcast, talking about our methods. And I wouldn't say that I'm fly or die, but I'm damn near fly or die. You know, if I'm out fishing with my kids, I'll use their spinning gear, help them out or the push button and stuff like that. But if I'm going fishing,
I'm going to use soft plastics like it's my job. Because.
Yeah. But if I'm fishing for myself, it's always a fly rod in hand.
I agree. For one thing, I've got too much money invested in the damn thing.
Right. So we've talked a lot about fishing and your time up in Alaska. When you were up there, did you do much hunting?
I did. The problem with hunting in Alaska is you basically have a 6-week window.
I see.
So you've got from mid-August to the end of September. So the problem is that's also prime time trophy trout fishing. So what you have to realize is when a guide gives up 10 days to go, say, moose hunting, he's not spending money to go moose hunting. He's given up $10,000+ in guiding to go moose hunting, which is going to cost him an additional $10,000.
Right.
So you're looking at $22,000 to $25,000 that guide's giving up to go harvest a moose.
I see.
Jeez.
So hunting is for the tourist, not necessarily for the guide.
Yeah. Now, did I harvest the moose? Oh, yes, I did. Awesome. There was not a time from 2003 to 2017 that I bought meat at a grocery store.
That's amazing.
Awesome.
Isn't that cool?
So how do you prepare your moose? I've only had moose in stews with rhubarb.
Okay. All right. Super cool. I mean, rhubarb is amazing flavor. Strawberry, the intaberry, the currant, the underflavors, and then you get the mousse all mixed into it, and life's good. And God forbid that you throw an IPA in there that's going to be so hopped up that you can't see straight. And, you know, you've got all these things, right? I mean, my last mousse that I killed in 2015 had a 73-inch paddle.
Wow. Oh my God.
So from paddle to paddle was 73-inch.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a 9-year-old moose. So, you know, we brought home usable meat was probably 1,100 pounds.
Holy hell.
That was on the fowl.
Incredible.
Yeah. So that was my trim tabs. My trim tabs was 1,100 pounds of usable meat sitting on my bow.
That's holy freaking crap. Insane.
In 30-degree weather.
Nice.
So I don't have a lot of family up there that are outdoorsmen, although my maternal aunt, so my mom's sister, she married a man who is an outdoorsman, avid fly fisher. bow hunter, and he used to bow hunt moose, and that man has some stories.
Yeah.
I've only met him a couple times. In fact, when I was up there last July, I went out fishing with him. You know, full of stories. I wish I had more of them than I've heard. But he's told me a few, and bow hunting moose in Alaska just seems extremely exhilarating.
It's ungodly, right? So you're literally taking your bow. You wear dun colors, right? Mm-hmm. So you'll wear a brown Carhartt. So you look like a frickin' moose. And then you put your bow on top of your head and you walk through the alders like this.
Uh-huh.
And you're scraping the sides of these alders to sound like a moose. Uh-huh. Well, this is a dangerous proposition.
Yeah.
Because the son of a bitch that shows up is jazzed up to run you down.
Yep.
So you better be on the pull, locked back to your ear or wherever your lock point is, and pointing at him. And the minute that you see shoulder, you better be cutting it loose. Right? Well, this is what Shockey and his crew never shows in their videos.
Yeah.
Now, do I like Jim Shockey? Of course I do. I mean, I've known his family for 20 plus years. Mm-hmm. You know, but is he showing what the reality is? No.
A lot of shows aren't.
No, yeah. None of them are.
Yeah.
I mean, Lee and Tiffany, for the love of Christ, and they're not showing reality. They're showing what sells.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's all subjugated back to a guy named Walt Larson, who is the promoter behind most of the TV shows that you see on Saturday morning.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Walt Larson owns Larson Advertising. Their number one client, 3M.
Really?
Yep. He has that number one client so that he can do all the fun shit.
Wrong dupe.
It went down the wrong pipe.
That it did.
Oh my God. Give him a minute, boys and girls. You'll be okay. He's a professional. He's gonna be all right.
I'm definitely editing that out so nobody's ever gonna know.
Hell, leave it in so they know you're human.
Right, right. I might need to do more of that.
So Lefty Cray told me one time, we were up on this little tiny creek, and Lefty Cray had caught, shit, I don't know, 30, 40 trout on dry flies. Uh-huh. And I looked at him, I said, my God, Lefty, have you had enough? He's like, he turns around, he looks at his producer. He said, do we have enough? He said, we've got enough for 4 shows. He says, oh, good. Everybody pick up a fly rod. My guide and I are going to go upstream a bit. And I look at Lefty and I said, they have no idea what just happened, do they? He said, no, they have no idea.
That's freaking awesome.
Hey, Lefty, one year he called me up. He said, Scott, he goes, I know I said I'd be there for the home opener. I said, well, yes, sir. But, you know, if you got something better to do. He goes, I've got the last invite before Cuba opens up. I'm like,
really?
Can I meet you in Miami? I said, my 7 weights are packed. I can be in Miami tomorrow.
Yeah.
He's like, unfortunately, I don't have enough room. Otherwise, I would invite you. But yeah, man, I got to go. I'm like, well, of course you do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, let me go, for God's sake. You know, and it was amazing. You know, my wife, God love her. I mean, everybody loves her because, well, she's Buffy. And so she's got to be pretty good Facebook friends with Victoria Cray, Lefty's daughter. And so they're talking about all this stuff. And Buffy comes home and she's like, oh, my God, they were talking about this trip and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, yeah, I was supposed to be on. She's like,
heartbreaking. Wow.
You're kidding me. I said, no, dear. Tech, you know, private message. Don't put it out there in the middle of everybody. private message Victoria and let her know who you're married to. And so she did, and Victoria went nuts. She's like, oh my God, you tell Scott I love him, and oh my God, blah, 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 blah. Oh my Lord, child, please. She's probably
that's freaking crazy.
5-10 years older than we are.
Uh-huh. So that's crazy that you bring up Cuba, because so we had talked about Cuba in one of a previous podcast about bass, about how, you know, a lot of people don't know that there are some massive Cuban bass. So we actually had a listener that sent us a message and sent us some pictures of some bass.
Yeah.
And a guy just literally walking around the gas station trying to sell them.
Yep.
Massive. Freaking massive.
But again,
so what it's on grasp, one of my bucket lists.
And hey brother, I'm with you. What those people grasp is that the Italians that they were marketing to wanted big, big, big fish.
Mm-hmm.
Pesca grande, right? They wanted the big ones. Yep. And so they learned, right? Much like the Bahamians learned, mm-hmm. quit killing them.
Yeah.
They grow bigger.
Yeah. You got to let them get big.
You know, my second cousin was doing a report for whatever class, freshwater resource management, who knows? Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, let them go so they can grow.
Yep.
And he latched onto this and he put it at whatever they call it now. It used to be called Southwest Texas State. What?
Sure, Texas State now.
Yeah, sure. Texas State. That's where I went.
Whatever they call it now.
Yeah.
And he put that into his report.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me up. He goes, Scott, you're not going to believe this, but everybody's latched onto it. I said, good. You did your job.
Yep.
Let them go so they can grow.
Exactly.
I saw a Facebook post today of this character who was in Beaufort, right, in North Carolina, mm-hmm. fishing the docks, and he caught a 34-inch speckled trout. Caught it.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't matter how. He caught the fish. Yep. And it's bouncing around the bottom of his kayak. Like, that's a dead fish. Kill it. Eat it.
Yeah.
You know, right. Live long and prosper.
Yeah. Net them.
And
unhook them. Let them go.
Shit.
Don't let them bounce around and give themselves brain damage.
Well, no, he already did that. It was over
with.
And I didn't react. I didn't send a message like I would have 10 years ago. It's amazing what 10 years of maturity will do for you. 10 years ago, I said, you rat bastard sons of bitches. What the fuck are you thinking? And, you know, he tried to release him. It wouldn't revive. Big old hen. I mean, we all know it's a female.
Yeah.
Because the males don't get over 24 to 25 inches.
Yep.
We understand that. We know it. And that big old hen, he couldn't help it. But mm-hmm. she was dead.
Yeah.
And at least he had the moxie to admit it. He didn't try to say, well, this fish was released. Well, no, it wasn't. She wasn't released.
Obviously. See, that's one thing that I respect about a lot of the White River guides here in Arkansas.
Yes.
For one, that's their livelihood. So they do take care of the fish because they do understand that the clients come from all over the country and some from you know, overseas to catch these massive trout that, granted, aren't indigenous, but to catch these massive brown trout. And they know that's their livelihood. So they care for this fish. They care for the water systems. They care for the fish. They make sure that, you know, it is netted. Their hands are wet, that they're keeping their protective slime. They take care of these fish and make sure that it's a successful release every time.
Yes.
And, and I try to do the same thing. You know, obviously I'm not a guide and I'm not taking people out, but even when I'm catching something, I try to do the same thing. I'm never laying a fish on, you know, on the bank or on my kayak or anything like that. I net it and I successfully release it. Unless of course if I'm catching that fish for a cookout, which hopefully soon I'll be doing a catch and cook, I don't know why I've just been really wanting to do that. There's this YouTube channel that I've found called, I think it's Northwest Fishing Secrets or something like that. It's this guy, he fishes a lot of alpine lakes. And he does a lot of catch and cooks. And I was like, I want to do that. But if my purpose is not to harvest the fish, I am taking care and I am making sure it's a successful release.
So at what point do we take the next generation and the generation after that into account? So on the White River, we have an amazing fishery where we take that into account.
Yes. Right?
We've got that fishery that goes off up the Norfolk. And, you know, if you're not under 16, you don't get in there.
Yeah.
With a rod.
Yeah.
And you can catch that 30-inch brown or better because they're there. Right?
Yeah. And I've seen pictures and I'm just like,
oh my God. Right? And for a guy, me personally, the biggest brown trout I've ever caught was 28 and a half.
Really?
On the Bighorn River.
I think my biggest trout was right at 30. Biggest brown trout was right at 30.
Fantastic.
I've caught a 28 inch cutthroat.
Fantastic.
And I hooked and lost a brown that was probably over 30.
As we all have.
Mm-hmm.
I hooked a brown trout on the Red Fork that was well in excess of 30 inches.
Yep.
The only reason we can call him that is because when he jumped, it was more like a lunge.
Really?
About half his body came out of the water.
That's crazy.
And
he had some size to him.
I did the client. Oh my God. I dropped the rod tip and leaned forward and came back and came back into nothing.
Yeah.
And my guide looked at me and he said, "You did that." And I said, I did. It's my fault. I didn't stay tight. My bad.
Yeah.
He said, "That was the one you were looking for." And I said, "It was."
Yep.
No one did.
We have those.
Yep. And this year on the Bighorn, I hooked Goliath.
Really?
And oh yeah. And that fish came out of the water except for the back third of his body. And I was down low. And as he came up, I went up, stayed tight, and went down to him for the battle. Uh-huh. And when I got to the bottom, he was gone.
Heartbreaker.
Oh,
damn.
It was. Until you realize who was in the boat, right? So it's Paul Harris on the sticks. He's been rowing that river for 38 years.
Oh, wow.
Right? He owns Bighorn Trout Shop.
Uh-huh.
Buffy's in the back because she won't fish in the front for whatever fucking reason. and I'm in the front with, you know, 7-weight swim fly.
Uh-huh.
You know, the best streamer rod ever built, backed up by an Able. I mean, this is the epitome of the best streamer rod combination ever built.
Right.
And I looked back at Hale and I said, "Hey man, I'm good. Bro out." He said, "Scott, we've got 4 miles of river." I said, "Yeah, I don't care." I don't care.
You got the experience at least for having it on there and seeing it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. For sure.
That's what I like to call a long distance release. That way I still feel successful.
LDR, for sure.
Just because I didn't touch it and get it to the boat, I still hooked it. I fought it for a little bit and I felt it and I seen it.
Yeah.
So it's an LDR.
LDR. And, you know, we fished out the rest of that week. We had a great Western Rivers trip. Phenomenal. Fished the green over in Pinedale. I love those guys. You know, they do a fantastic job. They work their ass off. For anything that Buffy and I want to do.
That's awesome. So I plan on making a trip at some point. I've actually been looking at property in Idaho. There's a few areas in Salmon that I'm looking at, and it would mainly just to be a place I can maybe put a tiny home or some type of, you know, cabin or camper or something, just where I can make a vacation trip out of.
Well, y'all are more than welcome to join us. on our little Western Rivers trip, you know, we spend 3 to 4 days in Pinedale and spend 3 to 4 days up in Fort Smith. Y'all are always more than welcome to join us.
That would be awesome.
There will never, ever, you know, Buffy plays outfitter because God knows I'm beyond that shit.
Well, I will happily take you up on that offer. But to circle back, you'd started asking a question of when, at one point, do we get the next generation to respect the fisheries? So I think a lot of that, so I've thought about that. And I think my tactic for that is going to be visual. So the younger generation likes to watch TikTok, likes to watch Instagram Reels, likes to watch YouTube Shorts. It's hard to keep their attention for an extended period of time, which is why majority of our listeners on podcast are of the 25 plus range. I think YouTube Shorts, TikToks, short form content is the way to, for lack of a better term, infiltrate the younger generation. And in addition to that, if there is more footage of fish releases, whether it be underwater footage, half and half footage, but footage of a successful release and trying to make it in an artistic way that is also popping and attention getting, I think that is one way that I can get to the younger generation, not saying, hey, you need to release a fish, or, you know, the science says this, you know, there's different ways to get the point across. And I think the visual aspect in short form would be the way to do it.
I agree with you. Until they know what it means to release that fish back into the wild. And I don't care if they're in Turks and Caicos, or they're in Key West, or they're in Port Mansfield, or they're on the White River.
Yeah.
Until they know what that feels like to release that living being back into its normal habitat, they have not lived.
Right, right. And my hope is to have this short form content reach them and then say, you know, I need to try that. I want to recreate this visual. This visual, whatever it be, a video of sorts. And to get more people to go out there and say, you know, I need to do that, I think I would, if I can get that to happen, I think I will feel like a success in the mission to do that.
I had a senator touch the belly of that king salmon. Tickle its belly with her fingers and release that 50-pound hen back into the system. And when she came up, she had tears in her eyes. She said, I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I said, yes, Senator, nobody else does either until you tell them.
Exactly.
When you release a fish that can spawn 5,000 to 7,000 eggs into the ecosystem, you don't know.
Until you've experienced it. Yeah, absolutely.
I said, how did that feel? Just know that this is why you were in my boat today. This is what you got to experience. And then I need you to go back to Congress. I need you to tell them.
Yeah, be an ambassador for what you've experienced. Absolutely.
Yes, 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 and yes, and more, my God, yes. And this is what they don't grasp. And Jose, what I would tell you is when they catch that 28-inch cow and they can tickle her belly and they can let that big trout go and they can feel it and they can sense it and they know what happened, they need to understand that they didn't release one trout, they released 20,000.
No, I completely agree, 100%. But I also think that science is important. It's not standalone, for sure. It can't be standalone. But science is a way for us to gain a better understanding of the natural world. That includes fish and wildlife. But I think, and I think this conversation is a perfect example of this, there were a lot of complexities with each individual when it comes to morals, when it comes to ethics, when it comes to experiences, that science alone and these rules and regulations cannot satisfy the wants and the needs of everyone who chooses to recreate. Like they just, there's just no satisfying. It's like politics. No one is going to satisfy everybody's like wants and needs for life. You know, like there's not one politician who a person can wholeheartedly agree with on every single topic. And, but that's not the basis. Like the basis is to try and hopefully give a better, to try and satisfy everyone to a certain point where they can at least be happy. It's more like the way I see it, it's more like a compromise. And to give you like, and I speak because, you know, like I'm in grad school, I'm going to school for ecology, conservation, biology. So I might be a bit biased, but I was trained to kind of see and use science and to try and better our natural resources. And to be quite honest, it's my experiences with the outdoors, hunting and fishing, that has led me on this trajectory to try and do that. And I agree with everything you said. I do agree that you need to let them go to let them grow, as you said. And it's the same thing with deer, like selective harvest can lead to bigger bucks and such and so forth. And I don't think fish are, you know, that different, but to rely on science alone, I think is problematic. Because everyone's, like we're going back to experiences. The fact is not everyone experiences fishing the same. For some people, it is to go out and get some food and whatever, and they don't care how big it is. They don't care how small it is. They don't care about any of that stuff. They just want to take the fish and go home. Then you have guides who are trying to make money and they're taking, you know, clients out who don't really care and they just want to get a limit and, you know, they'll do that, even if they may not totally agree with it, whatever. And then you get a lot of people who are conservation minded, who do care about that stuff. And, you know, like you said, they, to them, it's about the experience. They don't care if they catch that fish. They just want to experience it. So there's a whole gamut of people who go into the outdoors and every single day, and there's no way of satisfying them all. None. All we can do is try and compromise and give people the best experiences that we can while trying to keep everybody somewhat sort of happy. But even then that fails. So, you know, the science, like you just said, you know, a 28-inch female can put out 20,000 eggs. That comes from science. That comes from research. So that gives us a basis of an understanding to draw these conclusions and give us these understandings and things like that. So science does have a place, but so does ethics and so does morals. And so does everything else. And I think that's where a lot of our personal ethics and morals come in. You know, it's like that question, like just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should, you know, it doesn't make it right. And we see that all the time. You know, like I'm not going to lie to you. My biggest trout, it wasn't huge by what you may consider big. My biggest speckled trout was 23 inches. I was still in Kingsville at the time. I kept that fish and I regret that I did, but I didn't have the
understanding. Why do you regret it?
I regret it because I feel like it wasn't necessary. I had other fish on that stringer that would have all done the same. And it's just a personal thing. When I was filleting the fish and seeing how big it was compared to the other ones on that stringer, I was like, man, I should have let this one go. And it was too late at that point. You know, I fully admit to you, like it was too late at that point.
But what did you do the next time?
Well, I haven't been really fishing saltwater since then. And if I have, it was for redfish and stuff. So I never had the opportunity to catch a trout of that size since then. But knowing now what I know, I would let that fish go. It's not about the food at that point. If I want to take home some trout, a 16 incher, whatever.
Then brother, we have succeeded.
Yeah, exactly. So again, like I understand, you know, I think what I'm trying to do in saying all this stuff, I agree with you 100% as a conservationist, because that's also something that I believe in. I believe in the whole, you know, let them go to let them grow thing. But I also recognize that people's goals and things, they're all different. Life is all so complex. Our own morals and ethics and that compass that guides us, they're all different from one another. It's hard to satisfy the wants and the needs of everybody. We can only compromise, but even then compromise, someone's being left out. But nonetheless, you know, that's what we have to go on. But what we can do from there is we can use our own or utilize our own ethical and moral compasses to make our own decisions. Just because they have those rules and regulations set forth doesn't mean that we cannot place rules and regulations for ourselves, you know? And I think that's what people should probably do more often, you know, like you don't have to go and get those limits. And I think it's a graduation also. Like as a younger angler, I was all about getting limits. I was kind of disappointed about getting limits. I was the person that I mentioned before, you know, like we should really think about why getting a limit is so important. And I had to have that conversation with myself, and I did. And I have these moral and ethical conversations with myself all the time. And it's one of the, like, well, that's a topic for another conversation. But yeah, so I have these moral ethical conversations with myself all the time. And it's because of those that now I'm trying to be more conscientious of what fish I keep, more selective, the sizes, and you know, placing personal boundaries on myself and what, you know, I don't need to get, you know, the 5-trout limit or whatever it is. I don't need to get that, bring home that 3 redfish limit, whatever, like when 1 or 2 or 3 or whatever will suffice for myself or for my family. You know, I don't have to fill the freezer. I don't have to do that. I don't need to get a limit to be fulfilled. So I guess in saying all this, if anybody's, you know, still tuned in from my soapbox speech, like really, like, I think it's important to really ask yourself some hard questions. Like, why is it that you do what you do? When you post that picture of the buck on Instagram that you harvested or whatever, or that big redfish that you caught and are keeping, what is it that you're trying to achieve? Are you trying to brag a little bit? Are you trying to, I don't know, honor that fish or that buck in some way? If so, how are you doing that? You know, is that photo really doing, are you in that, with that photo, are you really honoring that, the animal whose life you took? You know, all these things, like these moral ethical questions, like you at some point should ask yourselves that if you feel the need to fulfill your limits and to whatever, keep, you know, the biggest fish, why is that? And if you don't like the answer, then maybe you ought to think about how you can change that. For me, from my Instagram, like I used to post pictures of like every animal that I ever shot, whatever. Now I think I removed most of them because I, at some point I had asked myself, what is it that I'm really trying to do with this? And when I answered that question, honestly, see, and that's the thing, like I don't mind people posting, you know, hunting videos or pictures. I don't. But for me personally, since hunting has like such a bad rep as it is, for, you know, the average person who doesn't engage in it, I don't think my photos are doing any better in portraying hunting in a good light.
I feel what you're saying.
Yeah.
And what I know is that until we teach my son, his sons, the sons after, we're done.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There are some changes, and I think we're all in agreement that there are some changes that need to be made in terms of morality and ethics.
And going back to Scott's point, like I'm a product of that. I was raised that what we caught is what we ate, whether it was like small panfish, bass, some turtles that we caught in the line, you know, whatever we caught, we ate. And it wasn't until I got older and started being able to like think to myself, and honestly, like this path that I went on allowed me to see a lot of the nuances and things that I wasn't thinking about or considering before, is when I think I started becoming more conservation minded. And I think that's a lot of what's going on. Like a lot of people who are all about keeping fish, they don't teach catch and release. They don't teach ethical harvesting and stuff like that. They just like, oh yeah, catch it, keep it, whatever. And you're right, Scott. We need to try and instill more conservation minded, like ethics and morals and things to the younger generation if we want to have this fishery that we are blessed to have, you know? And to even improve it and make it better.
I agree. I had the honor of fishing with Jay Watt Senior.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And he said, so you've positioned yourself to fish this sand pocket. I said, I have. And I'm going to catch 5 to 10 fish out of it. He said, do you mind showing me? I said, no, sir, not at all. And I dropped my soft plastic down into that mire, and I caught I think I caught 8 fish while the rest of the party in my group waded past it. They threw into it, didn't catch anything, and waded past it. And Jay looked at me, and he kind of grinned, and he looked at me, and he said, "You want me to tell him?" I said, "Not really, no." Because I'm going to go back, I'm going to hit these other 3 that we walked past. Mm-hmm. "This is where the fish are." He's like, "You bastard." I said, yes, sir, I am. I said, "I have learned where fish live and where fish eat. And where fish eat and live in certain temperatures."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. "I don't care what it's doing up above. I care what it's doing down below."
Yep.
Yeah.
And he watched me back off, and I fished the other 3, and I caught 2 dozen, 3 dozen, whatever it was, trout. Released every one of them. He said, "You truly are a fisherman." And I said, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I am."
See, that's something that I think about fly fishing is there's a lot more becoming, I guess, a fisherman in fly fishing, because anybody can go spend $18 on a Rapala that's going to piss a bass off and get it to bite. But as a fly fisherman, you have to understand what the fish does, certain temperatures, certain flows, certain bodies of water, certain times of year. And you have to understand what is going on with that fish at that time.
Preach. Doing great. He's doing great. Buffy's like, "Holy shit, Scott, shut the fuck up."
Let the man preach. Exactly. And that's one thing that I would have never understood if I didn't get into fly fishing itself. Because, you know, when you're a conventional fisherman, you're just buying the most expensive thing that pisses the fish off. And that's not what it's all about.
No. One year we showed up at the Bighorn, it was a full freaking moon. Everybody was sitting out by the campfire. They were like, "Oh my God, this is awesome." I grabbed Buffy. I threw her in the truck. I'm like, "Come on."
Yep.
And get down to the ramp. I'm like, "Throw out there as far as you can and hang on. Just hang on. Don't strip. Don't do shit. Just hang on."
Yeah.
And by the end of her drift, it was like, "Oh my God." And it buried her rod. I'm like, "Yeah, that's the fish you want. That's the one."
Exactly.
And she reels in this walleye, threw out there again, get another one. And she throws out there. She does the mend. She drives into it. She drifts down. Wham! I'm like, "Yes, there's the one." And she reels up a 5-pound brown trout.
Jeez. Damn.
I'm like, "Yes. Yes, honey. That's the one. That's the one you were looking for. Pop that one off." I'm like, "Get back out there." She stopped. Oh, my God. I was never so proud. She stopped. And she said, "These fish are eating whatever comes down the pike." I said, "Yes, sweetheart, they are."
Yep.
I said, "They just want to see edible meat."
Exactly.
And we just happen to have it.
Yep. See, that's one thing that some people don't understand. And there are a lot of people that do not fly fish at night. And originally, I was one of them. But there,
how'd that work?
There are a lot of fish that I've missed, but I've recently come across mousing for trout at night. And then secondary to that, striper fishing. So I have yet to catch a striper, and I've been doing a lot of research on them and trying to learn what the fish do, talk to other anglers that have been successful catching them. And most of them that I've spoken to have caught a striper in the generation at a dam. Whatever. Exactly. Go at night.
Go to Boston Harbor.
Well, I'm not talking about saltwater. I'm talking about landlocked. So saltwater striper are different. I'm just talking
about, if you really want to catch that 40-pounder, go to Boston Harbor.
Yeah. And I know they're out there. My thing right now is I've been doing a lot of research on what's more accessible to me with my schedule and my location. So there are massive striper on Lake Ouachita, right? So yes. That everybody that's catching them, fly anglers speaking. So I haven't talked to any conventional anglers. I haven't talked to any people that go over there on charters or anything like that, but people that I've talked to that are fly anglers. So my thing is, everybody's like, oh, go to the dams. Oh, go do this. And I'm just like, striper feed at night. Striper like to feed during the dark when there is light coming from above, and they like to hit their prey, let it drop, and attack. So I'm trying to plan a time when I can go out there in the wee hours of the morning or at night near a full moon and go fly fish at night and try to get a freaking massive striper. And everybody looks at me like I'm crazy when I talk about that. I don't understand. I don't see why that's not a thing that people do. Wee hours of the morning, foggy days when there's a mist over the lake, full moon, sunrise. To me, that speaks Striper City.
So what do y'all want to get out of this? I mean, I've got stories.
So Russell and I were just talking about that. I mean, we both feel like we've barely scratched the surface with like your stories and knowledge and everything. We'd love to hear more about it. But unfortunately, we can only do like an hour, 15, hour, 30 at max at the time. So
what do y'all need to further your perspectives?
The biggest thing that I have struggled with and what I need is what makes them want to listen to us? What makes them want to watch us? So I don't know how else to answer that question other than I just need to learn myself. Yeah. On how to get this out there. And I believe stories like yours and experiences like you've had are going to be the key to that. Because for one, it's entertaining. For two, it is full of knowledge and experience and just crazy stories that are captivating. And so I would say to kind of lump that into one answer is get more guests like the Eggemeyers on here that have the stories and the experiences to propel us forward to get people to want to listen.
Agreed. And first, great question, Scott. Out of the interviews we've done, no one's ever asked us. So that's pretty awesome. Second, I think I'm going to answer two parts for this episode alone. I think, so we usually do intros. We didn't do an intro for this one just because it started off strong and we didn't want to like interrupt the flow of how it was going because it was just so organic. It was great. It was awesome. And so we're probably going to end up doing a voiceover for this episode just because it was just that good. And we didn't want to interrupt it. So I think just how interesting in the vast variety of topics we covered for this episode alone, I think will be awesome. For the future, like Russell said, I think having the ability to have interesting guests of various backgrounds, experiences, and things to try and touch people of various backgrounds and things and try and get them involved and interested in the outdoors and what we're doing and conservation and stuff like that, I think is going to be ultimately our end goal. If we can educate people about things that are going on, the importance of conservation, the importance of enjoy being outside and finding your reasons for wanting to do that. And getting the younger generation involved as well and getting on the right track, though what that means is, you know, pretty vague. It can mean anything to anybody, but at least involved in going to the outdoors, I think that would probably be the broad scope of, you know, what we're trying to do with this podcast. And honestly, like I said, you and Buffy, I think we both think we barely scratched the surface, and we would love to have you guys back because y'all have been awesome. And yeah, we'd love to meet you guys at some point too. And it's just been awesome. It's been great. I've had a blast today, and I hope you have too.
Okay, so let me expand on that if I can.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Of course. Absolutely.
Right. Okay, and I don't mean this rudely. I don't mean this. You know, this is just a thing. So what you all are trying to do is get people interested in what we do.
Yes.
So do we want them to get involved in a fly fishing aspect where they go out and they don't succeed?
To an extent. To me, that's a part of the journey.
Granted, it is. Absolutely. You go out, you do your best, and you throw for days, and you do everything that somebody told you to do and you don't succeed, but you go back and you do it again.
But secondary to that, I am a big proponent of hiring a guide. So anytime that I go to a new body of water or to a new region or to somewhere across the country, I am a huge proponent of hiring a guide because that way you can learn. Because that guide makes their living off of fishing that fishery. and they're going to show you and tell you what you need to do in order to be successful. Mm-hmm. So if you go somewhere, for instance, like when you went to Alaska, you knew, I don't know a damn thing about this fishery, but you learned. And so I'm a big proponent on, if you go anywhere, whether it be a vacation or whether it be right up the street to a body you've never fished, it is a great, just, I mean, you might as well just, if you have the funds to do so, or you have, you know, somebody that you know that you can talk to take you out and guide you, go. Because that is a person that actually understands, for one, the body of water and how to be successful. But for two, guides are knowledgeable in the conservation. And so if you can hire a guide and get on the water with a guide, you're going to have a way better experience. And if you're not somebody that is conservation minded, being with a guide is going to give that to you. So I'm a huge proponent of hiring a guide.
Jose, your opinion.
So I agree and disagree to an extent. Let me explain. I've only ever been on one guided trip, and it was with Russell for his birthday 2-3 years ago. And it was an incredible experience. And I agree with him that if you have the means to hire a guide to go fishing or hunting or whatever in a place you've never been to, absolutely you can. But I also recognize that not everybody has the means to do that. I truly don't, being in the position that I am. So for me, I've had, just because of where I'm at in life, I've had to try and more DIY it, and through a lot of trial and error and more error and more failures than successes. But when I've had those successes, they've also been rewarding because of the time and effort that I put into it. And so with that, I recognize that, you know, our listeners may be in, you know, both of our shoes. There may be some who, you know, can hire guys, those cannot. And so I would like to try and appeal to both, you know, give some tips and tricks to help those who maybe don't have the means or who are more, I guess, DIY minded, but also acknowledge that, you know, guides are an excellent way. And for those who can go that route to, you know, go that route and like Russell said, you know, have those experiences as well. But I recognize though that it is, like, as much as, and I think we're trying to balance like having really interesting people with various experiences and who are willing to share the stories, because I think the stories captivate listeners, while also mixing in some drops of knowledge and things that they can then use and take and further their own experiences and stuff as well.
Well said. But is it the point where we take our clients, your listeners, I don't have clients at this point, but we take them beyond?
Explain what you mean by beyond.
Okay. So we take them and we introduce them.
And that's something that I can speak on in the quote unquote client side. Is the first time that I had a fly rod in my hand was with Jose. And I was one of those guys where the first cast that I made, I landed a fish, which is awesome in its own. But to say that, it was an experience, although it was a small fish, it was an experience that made me really appreciate the art of fly fishing. And it was a small fish,
but we celebrated like it was a big one.
Exactly. And I think that's the difference between conventional and fly, is you feel every head shake.
I agree. You will never get me to agree more. I have taken people fishing in the Amazons in freaking South Africa.
That's awesome.
All the way to, Buffy fished ranch potholes in mm-hmm. North Texas and caught 5-pound bass.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yes. But the thing is, to get that experience, that is what makes an angler.
Absolutely.
I don't care if it's a 20-pound peacock bass or it's a tarpon. It lives off the coast of Port O'Connor. I just want them to feel that body. I had a guy that told me, that he said, Scott, he goes, look, man, what you're putting me on these tarpon is epic. But you have to understand, the only thing I care about is the first two jumps in the run. And once I learned that, it was Katie Bore the Door, because I learned what yeah.
wanted. I learned what that angler wanted from the fishery.
So earlier when we were talking about becoming a guide, right? And you talked about your second cousin who said he was going to do this and do that. And it seemed like he was wanting to get into it for the fame, the notoriety, the riches, right? And Jose talked about the video that he had watched that had persuaded him not to become a guide. So the way that I see it is the best guides come from the people that have a love and a passion for fly fishing or for fishing in general and for the conservation of that fishery. So with what you just explained to me, what I take from that is you have a passion, obviously, for conservation. You have a passion for the sport of fly fishing. But on top of that, you have a passion for getting to know your client and how to get the information that you know transferred to that client. So I guess in a way, being a guide has to be something that you love and enjoy, and everything that comes with it cannot be your goal.
You found it.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's just the thought that came across my mind between that conversation and your comment now is, so anybody that is trying to become a guide or do anything for that matter has to be something to come from love and passion, not for what comes from it. Is that where you think you went?
Yes. The tug is the drug.
I love that term. Tug is the drug. So earlier this week, I went out and hit an urban creek here in Hot Springs with a 2-weight fiberglass rod, right? And I had the time of my life. It was amazing. Went out in the heat of the day, and there is a lot of green sunfish, bluegill, and long-eared sunfish here, and in this particular body of water. And it is to a point where they are extremely, because it's clear. I mean, it is clear water. They are extremely skittish to the point of they can feel the vibrations on the bank and they start scramming. And I had to actually like try to figure out what the hell I was doing, because I could see the fish and I could not get them to bite. And I couldn't get them to chase. I couldn't get them to even show any interest. And it took me a good hour and a half to even get the first bite. And then at that point, I was using a barbless hook and lost numerous ones of them because I'm a dumbass, forgot my net. And it took me a while before I started landing the fish. And I mean, granted, it was a 2-weight glass rod and I was catching fish that were at a max 4 inches long. Mm-hmm. But I had a blast, mainly on the fact that I had to relearn it. I had to relearn everything that I've learned in fly fishing to catch these tiny 3 and 4 inch fish, and it was extremely rewarding. And I'm in this urban area right next to a baseball field where there's a t-ball something or other going on, and you hear parents just screaming their heads off about a four-year-old that hit a ball off a tee, and I'm over here on a creek in urban Hot Springs getting even more excited than that because I caught a 2-inch and 3-inch freaking sunfish. So
I think we're all in agreement. We just come from different ways of getting there. Like, I agree with you, Scott, and Russell, and it kind of goes with my favorite quote. It's by Henry David Thoreau, and it goes, "Many go fishing all of their lives without knowing that it's not the fish that they're after." Like, I love that quote, and it took me a long time, admittedly, to get there and to really understand it. Before, when I was younger, I used to get mad if I like missed a fish, or if, like I said, I used to be a limit chaser. I used to get kind of bummed if I didn't get my limit or whatever. But now it's like, I don't even care. Like, I can go to my local creek, catch a couple bluegills and have a blast. It's not about any of that. It's about the experience. It's about being outdoors. It's about spending time with myself and enjoying what I'm doing, about sharing that with other people. It's not about the fish at all anymore. It's gone beyond that.
So Russell, if I can interrupt, I apologize, Jose, you answered the question. Russell, you answered the question amazingly. And so did you, Jose. What I would banter into this is that you taught a future generation how to fish.
In a sense.
No. No, you both taught a
generation how to fish.
Yes, that and that is the goal, and that is something that I continue to strive for doing, not only in my own children, but in others.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. When Buffy told me about this podcast, which I don't do podcasts, what I have realized about podcasts is they want to scream about killing fish.
There are a lot of those. Absolutely.
What I learned about your podcast by listening and not talking is that you don't.
Correct.
I find it exhilarating.
We really appreciate that. Yeah. And that's what our goal is.
Quite the compliment. Thank you.
You.
We want to captivate the listener and show them that it's not about killing the fish. It's about saving the fish. I don't think we can end on a better note. From a compliment from somebody as experienced and knowledgeable as you are, I think that's just a great ending point. And yeah, off of that, we really, really, genuinely appreciate you joining us on this podcast. I feel like I personally have learned a lot from you just in this podcast alone and have extremely enjoyed it. And once again, speaking for myself, I think this has been amazing. And I just want to thank you for hopping on with us because, you know, like you just said, you're not big into podcasts, and the fact that we have made an impact on you on the fact that we are actually trying to do something about conservation, that's just a great compliment from you in its own. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Russell, how do you feel?
Honestly, Scott, it's been a blast. I agree with everything Russell said. You like, and then this goes back to what I said earlier, honestly, totally honest, transparent. I have enjoyed the podcast that we've done with you and with Buffy. I think I've been some amazing guests, full of knowledge and experience that I hope we can learn more about you guys on, because I feel like if everybody can learn too. And it's been a blast. And you have made some really, really great points of and things to think about. And I know I'll be thinking a lot about it too. And it's just been a blast having you guys on. And, I didn't know that you didn't do podcasts, but the fact that you're sitting here with us today, giving us your time of day, means a lot. And the compliment that you had for us is also, it means a lot. We appreciate that. Especially since we're so new and we're trying to figure this out, and, you know, hopefully, you know, we can do a good service and spread the word about conservation and things and hopefully inspire, a new incoming of outdoors men and women to, you know, go about it ethically and just to have a good time. You know, it's all about being outdoors. You know, it's not about the fish, it's not about the deer. It's about all that is second to what the main goal is, I think. But yeah, it's just, you know, we thank you, Scott, for your time, and it's been a blast. I hope you've had a good time too. And we look forward to hopefully having more conversations with you and Buffy down the road.
Thank you. And let me end on this note, if I may. When we fish for a specific fish. Mm-hmm. We fish for that fish.
Yes.
Doesn't that suck?
It does, but it doesn't.
But it keeps bringing us back.
Gentlemen, I appreciate this time with y'all. Thank y'all so much.
Thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And I look forward to hearing about this.
Well, I should have it edited. And
anytime that y'all need us, we are here for your expectations.
Oh, we greatly appreciate that. And we need to make a trip down to see you guys in person.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Please do. If nothing else, we will sit around the campfire, tell stories, drink whiskey, and
we'll bring some love.
Bring some rum.
And there's a good humidor here in Hot Springs. I might bring some cigars.
He happens to have a humidor full of Cubans.
Well, I look forward to it. I really do. And once again, thank you for your time. It has been an amazing experience, and we look forward to speaking with you soon and hopefully seeing you in person.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
Y'all have a great night. And for the listeners, thank y'all for listening to the end. We appreciate everything. We hope you enjoyed it. And we'll just catch y'all next time.
Au revoir. Bonne chance. Bye-bye.
This has been Wildlife Outdoors. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Outdoors and on Instagram at wild.life.outdoors. Let's go live life on the wild side.